Hi, everyone. This is Mike DeBliss. Today's topic is the Fifth Amendment's essential role in offshore audits. And a little bit about me. I hope you've been following along with some of the previous programs I've presented. What we did was we actually created a series of presentations around tax. And I think it totals about 18 programs after we finish up the last couple months of them. And this series gives you some insight, some deep insight into tax topics that have interested me, and that I've been practicing for the last decade. So a little bit about me. I kind of had an unusual path into tax. I began my career as a lawyer, as a public defender in the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender. And while I was there, I cut my teeth on some of the most serious felony cases to pass through the courts of New Jersey. I tried a number of cases. I litigated hundreds of pretrial motions. Ironically enough, I knew before I got into the public defender's office that I wanted to get into white collar crime. And the reason for that was an experience that I had in my last year of law school. I clerked for a white-collar criminal defense firm in New Jersey that was just on the eve of beginning a trial. They were defending a man who had been accused of money laundering in the Colombian drug cartel. And he had run a legitimate business in the state of New Jersey, but the government had accused him of laundering the drug lord's money from drug sales. And I got familiar very quickly with tax crimes because there were a number of tax crimes that accompanied the money laundering crime. And those became the subject of fierce pretrial litigation. So I began the research and I got very familiar with those sections of the Internal Revenue Code, as well as those statutes that criminalized the tax offenses. So I had it in my mind that I wanted to circle back and really immerse myself in tax law so that I could take on these cases. And that's what I did. Halfway through my time at the public defender's office, I decided to go back to school to earn my master's in tax law. And I graduated 3 years later. It took me a little longer because I was working full time. And little did I know at the time that there was a whole world of tax beyond just criminal tax defense that really appealed to me, and that I knew I wanted to practice when I went into private practice. And so that has basically become many of the topics that I've presented in this series. Many of the topics are on civil tax controversies and the anatomy of a civil tax controversy. And then I walk you through tax court and the rules and procedures surrounding tax court. And then I also tackle this issue of the FBAR, or what's called, what it stands for is the Foreign Bank Account Report, and how the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program arose as a result of taxpayers, U.S. expats specifically, that were delinquent in filing these FBARs. So that's been the genesis of my career. Today, I would say that about half of my practice remains criminal defense, and the other half is civil tax controversies. So this topic is very near and dear to my heart. It's one that I'm very passionate about, and I am very excited to be presenting it to you in this series. So let's set the stage. There is what I'd call an inherent tension between the government and the taxpayer when it comes to information gathering. This is no more apparent than in the case of an offshore audit, where revenue agents are often armed with incomplete and potentially inaccurate information provided by foreign banks and need information that only the taxpayer or his accountant can provide in order to supply the missing link. If the government can't get the requested documents, it often cannot make a case. So the way the dance normally begins is that the government, the U.S. government, will issue a summons on the foreign bank to obtain what might be called nameless aggregates of U.S. taxpayers who are clients of that bank. And the whole theory behind that is that the government wants to ensure that the taxpayer A is reporting these foreign bank accounts on an FBAR, and B, that the interest income generated by these foreign bank accounts is being reported on the taxpayer's 1040 such that they're paying tax on them. And so we might want to back up even further and explore the tax system that the U.S. government has in place for its U.S. expats. Very simply, the U.S. stands almost alone. I think there might be only one or two other countries in that it taxes its citizens as well as its residents on their worldwide income. So regardless of where that income is generated, it could have been generated in South America, it could have been generated in Central Europe, it could have been generated in Eastern Europe, it could have been generated in Australia, it could have been generated in the Czech Republic, it could have been generated in Slovakia, it could have been generated in one of the Eastern Bloc countries, such that the taxpayer had a business in one of those countries. Even if, in keeping with this example, that the taxpayer had a business offshore and didn't have any U.S. customers, they would still have an obligation to pay taxes to the U.S. government. And so that's what is deemed a worldwide taxation system. And again, the U.S. stands practically alone in the world as one of the few countries that still taxes its citizens and residents on their worldwide income, regardless of where it's derived, and regardless of whether the taxpayer's company had any U.S. clients. So for example, the U.S. person could have a business based in South America, and that business might not have any U.S. customers, yet the gross receipts are taxable by the U.S. government. Well, you might ask, how about this issue of overlapping tax systems? If the U.S. taxes its citizens and residents on their worldwide income, how does that relate to the fact that the country where the taxpayer is doing business or residing also has a territorial tax system? Well, it's very interesting, the overlap of a U.S. worldwide tax system with the tax system of the country in which the taxpayer, in which the U.S. person resides. The U.S. government makes a small concession, and what they basically do is they say, U.S. taxpayer, we're still going to insist that we tax your worldwide income for U.S. tax purposes. However, what we're going to do is issue a credit. So the way a credit would work is, let's say, for example, that the U.S. person is in a 35% tax bracket in the United States, but the foreign tax bracket that the U.S. person is in is only 15%. Well, the way a tax credit would work in that scenario is that The taxpayer would pay 15% to the foreign taxing authority, and the taxpayer would remit the difference between 35%, the bracket that he's in the U.S., and the 15% that he paid in the foreign taxing jurisdiction. So what does that mean? That means that the U.S. person pays a 20% tax liability to the U.S. government. Again, that represents the difference between 35%, the tax bracket that he's in the United States, and 15%, the tax bracket that he's in the foreign country. And that way, the U.S. government gives the taxpayer somewhat of a break in the sense that they don't have to pay 35% to the U.S. government after paying 15% in the foreign taxing jurisdiction. So this is what I mean when I talk about how the U.S. government has a keen interest in determining two things: compliance as far as an FBAR is concerned, because a U.S. person has an absolute obligation to report their foreign accounts on the foreign bank account report form, which is a creature of the Bank Secrecy Act, but is enforced by the IRS. And then secondly, the U.S. government has an interest in ensuring that the interest income has been reported properly by the taxpayer on their 1040, such that they've been taxed on it. And the argument that we usually get, or the pushback that we usually get from the U.S. Client, is that the interest income is so minimal that at best, maybe it translates into $100 or $200 of tax liability. And yet the penalties on failing to file an FBAR can shoot right up into the stratosphere. They can be so painful, they actually could be as large as 50% of the end balance in the foreign account. And that penalty is based per account, not per tax year. So if there were, say, six accounts and six accounts were out of compliance, then the willful FBAR penalty could be assessed at 50% of the final account balance, or of the end of year account balance in each one of those accounts. So as you can imagine, the penalty for failing to file an FBAR is exponentially higher than any tax liability that the taxpayer would have had to pay to the U.S. And so the reverse argument, of course, is that, well, taxpayer, if your tax liability was so minimal, why didn't you just report on the FBAR your foreign accounts and pay what you deem to be a minimal tax liability to the U.S. government? So there are all sorts of moving parts and all sorts of factors that go into this. But suffice to say, the U.S. government has a vested interest in ensuring that all of the taxpayers' worldwide income has been self-reported. Make no mistake about it, offshore audits, which are typically based on third-party information received under FATCA — FATCA stands for the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, and it basically is a way for the U.S. government to gather information about taxpayers who would rather stay in the shadows and not disclose their foreign bank accounts. And what we'll talk about, if we have some time at the end of the program, is how FATCA accomplishes the information gathering that we discussed on the first slide here, that is quite scant if the U.S. government is unable to unleash its summons power on these foreign banks and gather what we call nameless aggregates, or information pertaining to the foreign banks' U.S. customers. And we'll see how that is accomplished by some of the treaties that are in effect. So offshore audits, which are typically based on third-party information received under FATCA, tax information agreements, or as a result of the Swiss bank program, are ripe for referral to CI. CI is the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS. For better or for worse, the third-party information usually supports a conclusion that the taxpayer violated one or more federal criminal statutes. For this reason, it should come as no surprise that few, if any, taxpayers are willing to assist the IRS in its phishing expedition. Surrendering such information is the modern-day equivalent of an old-fashioned Western duel, where one cowboy, the taxpayer, gives the other cowboy, an IRS revenue agent, the bullets and ammunition needed to load his empty barrel. In a very real sense, it's a silver bullet that the government needs to successfully prosecute the taxpayer. So as it stands to reason that the taxpayer isn't necessarily going to want to cooperate. And that is one of the chief reasons a client might come to you as a tax attorney for advice on whether they need to adhere to an IRS summons that they've been issued. Because of how devastating the information could be to the client's liberty, great care should be taken to assert all applicable privileges, including the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. So let's talk about the list of privileges. We have under the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, we have the privilege and testimony, and then we have the privilege and document production. We will be addressing the Fifth Amendment privilege in the context of document production. But there are other privileges as well. There's immunity, and then there's the attorney-client privilege and work product privileges. I don't have the time to address immunity and the attorney-client privilege and work product privileges in this program, but in other programs, I've covered those privileges. So let's talk about some background information here. Tax cases are document-intensive cases. They fall under the category of white-collar criminal defense cases, and it's not unusual for the government, when they do obtain all the information that they need to connect the dots and they have the roadmap to fraud mapped out, it's not unusual for the government to provide defense counsel with a veritable data dump of information. And it becomes your task as the attorney to parse through thousands and thousands of documents in order to find what information is most relevant to the government's case. The government isn't going to highlight for you what documents it intends to use. And when you're talking about thousands of pages of documents, you don't even know sometimes if the government has identified certain items in the discovery packet, at least at that point in time. But suffice to say, if the government has it in their possession, they have the resources and the manpower to go through all of those documents. So it's a safe bet that they probably know about the needle in the haystack. And I wouldn't advise thinking that they didn't. As previously discussed, if the government cannot get the requested documents, it often cannot make a case. It is for this reason that the seminal issue in document production cases is whether the taxpayer has a Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to the documents that he possesses. So what does the Fifth Amendment say? And this is a little curt, but it gives us a starting point. No person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Ordinarily, the Fifth Amendment applies to the live testimony of a witness at a judicial proceeding in a criminal trial or during custodial interrogation of a suspect by law enforcement. It may also be asserted during a congressional hearing before a House Oversight Committee, such as that involving Mark McGuire during the committee's open hearings on steroid use in Major League Baseball. I realize that does go back a bit. It goes back to 2005, but that just demonstrates the broad sweep of the Fifth Amendment. But live testimony is not all that the Fifth Amendment protects. It also protects something just as sacrosanct. the compelled production of business records in certain situations. And there is a trio of cases that flesh out this concept. The Fifth Amendment privilege is fairly straightforward in cases involving testimony, but it has proven to be a bit elusive and confounding. I like to compare it to that Confucius curse in Harry Potter. And when it comes to applying it in the document production cases. During the government's information gathering stage, Fifth Amendment concerns arise when the taxpayer is asked to produce records or other documents. So what I like to do is I like to ask questions as we go through the program, just to make sure that you're following along. And that any topics that might be muddy are clarified by the answer to these questions. So now is no better time. Who bears the burden of proving that the privilege exists? And there's two choices here: the taxpayer or the court. Well, the answer is A. The taxpayer. The taxpayer must make at least a prima facie showing that responding to the information request would criminally implicate him, either in this crime or in another crime. Federal jurisprudence attempts to balance two overriding objectives. First, the desire to protect individual citizens from excessive governmental intrusion against two, the government's need to properly enforce the laws by using evidence independently obtained through skillful investigation. So it's those two goals that are constantly being negotiated. And again, it's a desire to protect individual citizens from excessive governmental intrusion against the government's need to properly enforce the laws by using evidence independently obtained through investigation. In order for the privilege to apply, statements must be compelled at the time they are made. Now, compelled is, of course, a term of art. And every legal term, we have to have very specific meaning and a very specific definition for it. I like to look at compelled in comparison to another, in comparison to another verb, and that is voluntarily, because voluntarily tends to be the diametric opposite to compelled. So, for example, a witness who voluntarily testifies or willingly produces documents in response to a summons or subpoena cannot claim the privilege. Why? Because they are, at the risk of overusing this same word, but they are voluntarily turning it over. There's no compulsion involved when a witness basically says, here it is, IRS, I'm handing it to you. And of course, that's a, you know, and that's a gross simplification of what goes on. But nonetheless, there's no compulsion involved when a witness voluntarily turns something over in response to a summons. The act of producing documents in response to a subpoena may be subject to the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. That comes out of the case of Fisher versus United States. It was a Circuit Court of Appeals case. So what are the facts, or what were the facts in Fisher? In Fisher, the government issued summonses for the records of two taxpayers, which were created by the taxpayer's accountant, but later transferred to and held by attorneys for tax preparation. So once again, what we have going on here is we have the government issuing summonses for the records of two taxpayers. Those records were generated by the taxpayer's accountant, but had later been transferred to and held by the taxpayer's attorney for tax preparation purposes. The court held that enforcement of the summonses did not violate the Fifth Amendment privilege. And of course, what that means is that those those records get turned over to the IRS. However, in a unanimous opinion, the court refused to cut the Fifth Amendment completely loose from the moorings of its language and make it serve as a general protector of privacy. The decision left the door open for future Fifth Amendment application in tax cases. So, what are the takeaways from Fisher? There are many. First, even if the documents themselves aren't privileged, the act of producing them in response to a subpoena nevertheless has communicative aspects of its own, wholly independent of the contents of the papers produced. So a good way to look at this is that we are not so much interested in the substance or the contents of the records and papers produced. What we are interested in when it comes to this Fifth Amendment privilege of production is what stems from the act of producing the records and the documents. The theory being that the act of producing records and documents has communicative aspects in and of itself, wholly independent of the substance of the papers produced. And if this testimony and admission that the requested, and if this testimony and admission that the requested documents exist is critical to the prosecutor's case, and not merely a foregone conclusion that adds little or nothing to the sum total of the government's information, the privilege may attach. What we have to recognize here, and I might have bit off more than I can chew in this second point, but let me back up for a second. The act of producing documents and records, once again, has communicative aspects of its own. By producing records, there is an admission that the requested documents exist. And so if this testimony is critical to the prosecutor's case and not merely a foregone conclusion, then the privilege may attach. So what I've uncovered for you in this in point two is that one of the communicative aspects of producing documents is that the requested documents exist. Otherwise, there would have been no documents to produce or to turn over. And then in point three, if the existence and location of the papers are a foregone conclusion, and the taxpayer adds little or nothing to the sum total of the government's information by conceding that he, in fact, has the papers, then the act of production privilege does not apply. Okay, so deconstructing point three is that, once again, if the existence and location of the papers don't add anything to sum total of the government's information, and that by conceding the fact that he has the papers, that the taxpayer has the papers, doesn't add much to the government's case, then the act of production privilege doesn't apply. The plot thickens with the case of United States versus Hubble. The somewhat infamous Whitewater case. In 1996, independent prosecutor Kenneth Starr served a subpoena duce tecum on former Arkansas lawyer Webb Hubble. And what did that subpoena order Mr. Hubble to do? It ordered him to bring documents before a Little Rock grand jury. He subsequently refused to testify about the documents or even acknowledge whether or not they existed, relying upon his Fifth Amendment rights. The federal district court threw out the subpoena as a quintessential fishing expedition, but an appeals court later reinstated it. What was the defense's argument? It went something like this. The only way that the government was able to bring this prosecution was through the information that I produced. And the court held that the indictment should be dismissed. And what we can see here is that this argument was crafted very well by defense counsel, because it went to the heart of this issue about the Fifth Amendment production privilege. Once again, it says, if the existence and location of the papers are a foregone conclusion and the taxpayer adds little or nothing to the sum total of the government's information by conceding that he has them, the act of production privilege doesn't apply. Well, far from adding little or nothing to the government's case, the defense's argument was that the only way the government was ever able to bring this prosecution was through the information that had been compelled, that I had been compelled to produce. And so that's why this was a winning argument, at least at the federal district court level. The Supreme Court of the United States held that where a document communicates information about the document's existence, about its custody, and about its authenticity, then the mere act of production is incriminatory and the Fifth Amendment privilege applies. Again, taking a very broad view, and by broad view, I mean that we're on the top of Mount Everest and we are looking down. We are not interested, at least insofar as the document production privilege is concerned, with the substance of the documents produced. What we are interested in is the communicatory aspects of turning documents and records over to the government. And what does that involve? Well, by turning over documents in response to a subpoena or a summons, the taxpayer is proving three things. A, that those documents exist. B, that he, the taxpayer, had custody over them. And three, authenticity. And now you might be able to see why this Fifth Amendment privilege of production is considered to be so sacrosanct that we've elevated it to the level of constitutional magnitude. Because at the end of the day, how do documents get moved into evidence in the court of law? Well, they have to be authenticated. Don't ever forget what our evidence professors taught us in evidence. They taught us that every piece of evidence should be considered excludable unless the moving party can point to a rule of evidence that allows for them to be admissible. Well, authentication is a step that must be taken by the moving party before that item of evidence can be moved into evidence. And as we can see here, the act of producing documents and records in response to a subpoena or summons proves their existence, that the taxpayer had custody over them, and it authenticates them. And so that's why we've elevated this document production to constitutional magnitude. And again, we don't want to get, we don't want to confuse the forest from the trees. We aren't dealing with the substance of the documents themselves, meaning what is written or stated on them and their contents. We're dealing with what communicative aspects are revealed by way of disclosing, by way of turning them over to the government in response to a summons or subpoena. In a near unanimous opinion, Justice Stevens essentially extended Fisher. Once again, he focused on the production aspect as analogous to testimony, likening it to a prisoner forced to try on a shirt in order to link him with a prior criminal act. The compelled testimony that is relevant in this case is not to be found in the contents of the documents produced in response to the subpoena. It is rather the testimony inherent.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is CUT. C-U-T. All lowercase. CUT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is CUT. C-U-T. All lowercase. CUT. Please take a moment and write this down.
In the act of producing those documents, the justice explained. Further, unlike the facts in Fisher, Prosecutor Starr would have had absolutely no case against Mr. Hubble unless he had access to the withheld documents. In Fisher, it didn't really mean the difference between whether the government would have a case or not. But in the Hubble case, by turning those documents over, that basically gave the government the ammunition that it needed to fire on all cylinders and to subsequently indict the case. In sum, we have no doubt that the constitutional privilege against self-incrimination protects the target of a grand jury investigation from being compelled to answer questions designed to elicit information about the existence of sources of potentially incriminating evidence, Justice Stevens concluded. And what refreshing words these are to our jurisprudence. The analysis in this case went something like this. The information was so voluminous that the prosecutor needed the defendant's assistance both to identify potential sources of information and to produce those sources. Given the breadth of the categories of documents called for by the subpoena, the collection and production of the materials demanded was tantamount to answering a series of detailed interrogatories or a series of deposition questions. That's powerful language, and that's language that you can hang your hat on for in a contest like this one. Again, the court analogized the collection and production of the materials demanded with answering a series of detailed interrogatories or a series of deposition questions. And then they went on to say, providing a catalog of existing documents fitting within any one of 11 broadly worded categories could surely provide a prosecutor with leads to incriminating evidence. What does the act of producing documents concede? First, it concedes the existence of the documents demanded. Second, their possession or control by the taxpayer. And third, the taxpayer's belief that the documents produced are those described in the subpoena, a fact that the government may later use to authenticate them. That's how we get to the third prong that the act of producing the documents concedes authentication. Once again, the way that that's accomplished is that the government would go to court and say, well, the taxpayer obviously believed that these documents were what was being asked for by the subpoena. Otherwise, they would not have been included by the taxpayer and in what he turned over. And so once again, the government can use that fact to authenticate those documents for purposes of moving them into evidence at trial. So it's a good idea to memorize these three principles: that the act of producing documents concedes their existence, their possession or control by the taxpayer, and third, the taxpayer's belief that the documents produced are those described in the subpoena. The privilege applies only to compelled testimony. That comes from the case of U.S. versus Couch. Once again, I always like to look at compelled in comparison to voluntarily prepared, because documents that are voluntarily prepared are not privileged. Why? For the simple reason that no compulsion is present. The taxpayer is turning them over voluntarily without the government needing to take them to court to enforce the summons. And summonses are not self-enforcing. So yes, if the taxpayer refuses to abide by a summons, then the government has to take the taxpayer to court. So it's you know, the example here is that a taxpayer who voluntarily produces documents in response to a summons or subpoena cannot later claim the privilege. That's why it's critical that if the taxpayer is issued a summons at the earliest opportunity, they should at least consult with a tax attorney. They probably have an accountant, but the accountant should always bring the attorney onto the team to at least provide the taxpayer with some sound advice on whether to submit the documents in response to the summons or whether not to. The privilege protects a person only against being incriminated by his own compelled testimonial communications. Documents prepared by individuals other than the taxpayer are not protected. And that comes out of Fisher versus United States. So as you can imagine, there are a myriad of documents prepared by individuals other than the taxpayer, such as the taxpayer's accountant. And once again, the privilege only protects a person against being incriminated by their own compelled testimonial communications. So in this case, the issue was, are the tax records of a taxpayer created by the taxpayer's accountant, but later transferred to and held by attorneys, presumably hired by the taxpayer for tax preparation, whether they are subject to the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination? The tax records in Fisher were deemed to be the accountant's own work papers. The taxpayer's tax records obtained through a summons on the taxpayer's attorney are not protected by the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. Again, they were documents prepared by the taxpayer's accountants, and they were held by the taxpayer's attorneys for tax preparation. So there was not the element of compulsion of the taxpayer's own testimonial communications. Analysis here was that the summons and the order of the court enforcing it were directed against the accountant, not the taxpayer. The accountant's work papers are not the taxpayer's. They were generated, created by the accountant himself. They were not prepared by the taxpayer, nor do they contain any testimonial declarations by him. Therefore, the essential ingredient of personal compulsion against an accused is lacking. And in that example, in that case, the accountant's work papers were deemed to be discoverable, and the government was deemed to be able to possess them. So we have to do the type of analysis, even though it's a very granular analysis, but we have to do this type of analysis when a taxpayer comes to us, a prospective client comes to us asking us whether he or she can have any, whether he or she has any defense to the summons. And again, you know, you want to look to see who the creator of the material was that the government is seeking to obtain. And to the extent that it was work papers created by the accountant, then that fact would remove the fact of compulsion from the taxpayer, because these documents were prepared by someone other than the taxpayer. And as we can see here, the essential ingredient of personal compulsion against the accused is lacking when the summons is issued when the summons is issued to the taxpayer's accountant, or actually, yeah, it might have been issued in this case to the taxpayer's attorney, but nonetheless, it was the accountant who generated those work papers. And so again, the element of personal compulsion against an accused is lacking. So here we have a question. What if the tax records were still in the taxpayer's possession? Would that alter the result? And we have two options here, true or false. The answer is false. And the reason why it's false is because even if the tax records were still in the taxpayer's possession, the fact remains that the work papers were generated by the accountant and not by the taxpayer. So even though the work papers might have been in the taxpayer's possession, they weren't created. They weren't prepared by the taxpayer. They were prepared by the accountant. So, and they didn't contain any testimonial declarations by him. Therefore, once again, the essential ingredient of personal compulsion against an accused is lacking, and that would not alter the result, and those documents would still have to be turned over. However, the court did acknowledge two important things. First, that a subpoena served on a taxpayer requiring him to produce an accountant's work papers in his possession involves substantial compulsion. So we did get a minor concession here that even though the work papers were created by the accountant, the fact that the subpoena was served on the taxpayer requiring him to produce his accountant's work papers does involve substantial compulsion. And second, that the contents of the accountant's work papers might very well be incriminating. But here we are referring to the substance of the work papers. And recall that with document production, we're not looking at the substance of the work papers. We're looking at the act of turning them over and what testimonial things are revealed by way of turning over work papers or documents or records. But nonetheless, we get a nice concession or acknowledgement by the court as to the fact that the contents of the accountant's work papers might very well be incriminating. But the act of producing the work papers is once again all that the taxpayer is being compelled to do. It does not compel oral testimony. In other words, it doesn't compel the taxpayer to restate, repeat, or affirm the truth of the contents of the documents sought. That's why the act of production didn't cover the turning over of the accountant's work papers by the taxpayer to the government. Once again, these work papers do not compel oral testimony. In other words, it doesn't compel the taxpayer to restate, repeat, or affirm the truth of the contents of the documents sought. The act of producing the work papers is all that the taxpayer was being compelled to do. What Fisher stands for? It stands for the fact that the privilege against self-incrimination protects only the act of producing subpoenaed evidence and not the tacit averments within the documents themselves. What if the taxpayer is a corporation? Does a privilege apply if the corporation receives a summons or subpoena for records? The answer here is it does not. There is what's called a collective entity doctrine. Corporations and entities have no Fifth Amendment privilege. Only the individual who responds on behalf of the corporation, who will call the custodian of records, can potentially assert the privilege. Timeliness. If an objection exists, it must be asserted at the right time. There are both legal and ethical questions surrounding this. First, it's a matter of professional responsibility. Defense counsel cannot instruct his client to disregard a summons unless there is at least a good faith basis to challenge it. If no such basis exists, defense counsel cannot instruct his client to ignore it. There's usually three bases for contesting a summons. I do cover them in one of the other programs that I did on IRS summonses and subpoenas. But suffice to say, the government, the taxpayer, must have a good faith basis to mount a challenge to a summons. If there is a good faith basis to challenge a summons, when should the privilege be asserted? We have A, at the earliest stage possible so that it is preserved, preferably during the summons enforcement process, or B, at a contempt proceeding after the taxpayer defies a court order enforcing compliance of the summons and the court is considering imposing sanctions. Well, this is a very direct question, and A should be popping out at you like a neon sign at the earliest stage possible so that it can be preserved. You don't want to wait until a contempt proceeding, because by the time you've reached a contempt proceeding, and if the taxpayer has defied a court order enforcing compliance of the summons, and the court is imposing sanctions, it of course is the train has left the station. It's then too late to mount a challenge to the summons. You want to do it at the earliest stage possible. The prosecutor has the ability to confer act of production immunity. So let's set the scene here. Let's say that the government really wants the documents or records, but under Fisher, the very act of turning it over would be incriminating. The government can grant the taxpayer immunity with respect to the act of production. What does that mean? Well, the government cannot later use the fact that the taxpayer turned the documents over in response to a subpoena or summons to authenticate them. In other words, the government can't use the defendant to vouch for the fact that the information is authentic and that it's responsive. So all we're doing is we're taking the testimonial aspects of producing documents, and we're negating them. Because what's happened here is that the government is issuing the taxpayer active production immunity, or a shield against the government being able to use the act of producing the documents to prove that the taxpayer had possession of them, that the taxpayer turned them over in response to the summons, and third, authentication. So the government basically cannot use the fact that the taxpayer turned the documents over in response to the subpoena to authenticate them. And that's what the act of production immunity grants the taxpayer or defendant. If the government grants a taxpayer active production immunity, how would it then authenticate the documents at trial? Authentication, I like to use a short form, is that authentication equals possession and production. Example, let's suppose that the taxpayer owns a corporation and that the government wants to introduce documents that it obtained from the corporation in response to a subpoena. How would the government show that the corporation possessed the documents requested by the subpoena and produced them in response to the subpoena? Remember, those are two of the key elements of what producing documents reveals. Assume again that the government has granted the taxpayer active production immunity, and so now we're left to wonder or speculate on how the government would authenticate under a scenario like this one where it's granted the taxpayer active production immunity. Think chain of custody. How can the government establish chain of custody? Well, the government can call two essential witnesses into court to testify. First, the process server, who was the one who delivered the subpoena to the corporation. And second, the individual namely the custodian of records within the corporation who received the subpoena. So once again, the government will call into trial these two witnesses to testify, the process server and the custodian of records. The jury would then have to infer from this testimony that the corporation possessed the records and that it produced them in response to the subpoena. And that wouldn't be such a large burden for the government to conquer, because by bringing these two witnesses into court to testify, the jury would easily be able to infer from this testimony that the corporation possessed the records and that it produced them in response to the subpoena. Here we have the case of Braswell versus United States. It's a circuit court case. In that case, the issue was, can the custodian of records claim the privilege under the act of production doctrine on the grounds that his act of production would be personally incriminating? So to add a little more meat on the bones here, what if the taxpayer was the sole shareholder of the corporation and that he wore all of the hats in the company, from marketing to product development to public relations to custodian of records? The argument might sound something like this: any production by the corporation would surely be viewed by the jury as having been done by me, the company's alter ego. So yes, when you get into a situation where the company or the corporation is a small mom and pop shop, where the sole shareholder of the corporation does everything and wears all of these hats, it stands to reason that any production by the corporation would surely be viewed by the jury as having been done by the taxpayer, because at the end of the day, the taxpayer is the company's alter ego. He is the company. He is the face of the company. The answer is no. The custodian of records cannot claim the privilege under the act of production doctrine on the grounds that his act of production would be personally incriminating. How does all this apply to foreign bank account records? Well, a good way to back us into this is what I was talking about at the beginning of the program, and that is the Bank Secrecy Act. The Bank Secrecy Act requires taxpayers to annually report to the IRS foreign bank accounts in which a taxpayer has a financial interest or signatory authority. The form on which this disclosure is made is called a foreign bank account report, or an FBAR. Once again, the FBAR is a creature of the Bank Secrecy Act. It's been on the record since time immemorial. It didn't start getting much attention until the aftermath of 9/11, when we had the terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. The reason why is because the government began to look for the low-hanging fruit, meaning what laws were already enacted that they could rely upon to gather information that might lead to stamping out and eroding terrorist organizations. The government viewed the FBAR as one such tool that was already on the books and that could, and that just hadn't been enforced with the abandon that they needed to enforce it with prior to 9/11/2001. And so the government basically saw the FBAR as a way to ferret out terrorist organizations that were getting money from legitimate organizations or illegitimate organizations. And so the government started to enforce the FBAR with abandon and gusto in the aftermath of 9/11/2001. It also was a great revenue producer for the government, which was very cash strapped in the wake of 9/11 as well, because the failure to file an FBAR had some very heavy-handed fines. There were what was called non-willful civil FBAR penalties, which were small, but then there were willful FBAR penalties. And of course, the government had the burden of proving that the taxpayer was willful. And willfulness basically is defined as an intentional violation of a known legal duty. But the government was able to assert willful FBAR penalties. And when they did, they were able to collect 50% of the end of year balance on each foreign bank account that had not been disclosed. So you can imagine that those taxpayers that had multiple foreign bank accounts and that had been deemed willful were paying, in some cases, their retirement to the IRS. That's how onerous those willful FBAR penalties were. In addition to the reporting requirement, the Bank Secrecy Act also requires taxpayers to maintain for a period of 5 years records for each foreign account, including 1, the name in which each account is maintained, 2, the number of other designation, the number or other designation of such account, 3, the name and address of the foreign bank or other person with whom such account is maintained, 4, the type of such account, and 5, the maximum value of such account during the reporting period. The regulations don't articulate how to compute the 5-year retention period, but it is generally agreed that the 5-year period is calculated by reference to the current year, not by reference to the year under audit. So, for example, if the IRS issued a summons back on November 1st of 2016, the Bank Secrecy Act requires the taxpayer to only maintain records concerning the foreign bank accounts retroactively from November 1st of 2011. The required records doctrine, as informed by Fisher and Hubble, has been extended to documents required to be maintained under the Bank Secrecy Act. But hold on, the Fifth Amendment only protects individuals from compelled testimony, so there's a required records exception. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit was the first appellate court to weigh in. It decided that the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination could be raised in response to a subpoena demanding the production of offshore bank account records. I'm just going to take a quick drink of water. So that was a very refreshing holding for taxpayers, that the Fifth Amendment privilege could be raised in response to a subpoena demanding the production of offshore bank account records. In 2011, in a case named In Re MH, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the records sought through the subpoena fell under the required records exception and the Fifth Amendment privilege did not apply. In other words, the Ninth Circuit held that the required records exception rendered the Fifth Amendment defense useless in Bank Secrecy Act cases. So far, the Court of Appeals for the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 7th, 9th, and 11th circuits have agreed that the required records exception requires taxpayers to produce foreign bank account information required to be kept under the Bank Secrecy Act. The IRS and the U.S. Department of Justice, TAX, have issued summonses and grand jury subpoenas seeking information required to be kept under the Bank Secrecy Act. There has been an inordinate amount of litigation surrounding whether and the extent to which these documents must be produced. In U.S. versus Greenfield, the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit narrowed the scope of the required records exception as it applies to alleged Bank Secrecy Act violations. In Greenfield, the IRS learned that Stephen Greenfield was involved with certain nefarious offshore entities used to evade U.S. tax. 2005 was an unlucky year for Greenfield. The IRS selected his 2005 federal income tax return for audit. In 2013, the IRS issued an information document request and a summons directing him to produce documents relating to both his domestic and foreign bank accounts, including every account over which Stephen Greenfield had signature authority or over which Stephen Greenfield exercised control during the years 2001 through 2011. If the concept of overbreath is ringing out to you right now, you're on the right track. Even mathematically and linguistically, challenged readers can surmise that such a request goes well beyond the five-year Foreign Account Bank Secrecy Act records requirement. Once again, we're talking about a period that goes back from 2001 through 2011. That's a 10-year period. To add insult to injury, the summons further requested Greenfield to produce all documents in his possession for each bank account. Greenfield refused to comply with the summons, objecting on the grounds that the summons was overbroad. The government brought an enforcement action in 2014. Greenfield responded with a motion to quash, arguing that the compelled production of the documents sought would violate his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York sided with the government. In doing so, it enforced the summons and ordered Greenfield to produce the requested foreign bank account information. Greenfield, of course, wasn't happy, and he appealed that decision to the Second Circuit. That's the circuit for which appeals go from the United States District Court for the Southern District. The Second Circuit reversed the District Court's order requiring Greenfield to produce the records. In a sweeping decision, the Court of Appeals held that turning over anything other than the narrow set of documents covered by the required records exception violated Mr. Greenfield's Fifth Amendment rights. Thus, the documents requested were outside the scope of the required records exception to the Fifth Amendment's Act of Production privilege. The court reasoned that it was not reasonable to infer that a taxpayer was in possession of certain documents pertaining to foreign bank accounts that preceded the Bank Secrecy Act's five-year record-keeping requirement. Specifically, it noted that more than a decade had passed since Greenfield was known to be in possession of certain documents. Greenfield is essentially pay dirt. Suppose that your client receives an information document request or a summons from the IRS sealed with a KISS seeking foreign bank account information. In addition to being overly broad, the subpoena language is also very vague as to what the IRS does and does not already have. Your gut tells you that something isn't right. Should you object to the IDR or summons citing Greenfield? Absolutely 100%. The Greenfield decision has rippling effects for offshore audits. Information document requests and summonses in many offshore audits have finally met their match. To put it bluntly, IDRs and summonses are often nothing more than a fishing expedition where the revenue agent, armed with incomplete and potentially inaccurate information provided by foreign banks, asks the taxpayer to provide the missing link to a shoddy investigation in order to solve the crime. The existence and whereabouts of the documents requested are usually unknown to the IRS. It is a rare situation in which any good can come out of assisting the IRS in its fishing expedition. That's why, once again, you want to object to the IDR or summons citing the Greenfield case. The existence, okay, and we already covered this. When in doubt, always err on the side of caution and invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege. Whenever you can raise your argument to the level of constitutional magnitude, you know at the very least you're going to get a hearing because the judges are very careful when arguments are couched in terms of a violation of the client's constitutional rights, to give them short shrift. They will always, at least, at the very least, get an argument or hearing. There are three situations that are ripe for raising the Fifth Amendment Act of Production Privilege as a defense to producing foreign bank account records. As previously discussed, in response to an IDR or a summons seeking information about offshore bank accounts. Second, during an IRS interview, when the agent asserts that they have third-party information that allegedly links your client to a violation of the tax code, but when the rubber meets the road, they categorically refuse to disclose anything about the documents in their possession. That would be another circumstance in which a Fifth Amendment Act of Production privilege defense is ripe. And then third, in response to a revenue agent's request to file past due international information returns to toll the meter from continuing to run on penalties. And it goes without saying that this is very serious. Audits of taxpayers who made quiet disclosures, who inappropriately entered into the Streamline program. What the Streamline program is a program that was created by the IRS to allow those taxpayers who have failed to report their foreign assets on a Form 8938 or failed to report their foreign bank accounts on an FBAR and are looking to get into compliance, the Streamline procedures offer them a program to get into compliance with their foreign account and foreign asset obligations by paying a nominal penalty. For the Streamline domestic program, it's 5% of their foreign assets. And what they do is there's a look back period that goes back essentially 6 years in time for the non-compliance with respect to the FBAR and 3 years in time for the non-compliance with respect to other foreign specified assets. And essentially what you do is you take the highest year out of those 6 years and you multiply that by 0.05 to come up with the miscellaneous offshore penalty. That would be what the taxpayer has to pay, and then they have to go back and, of course, file delinquent FBARs for 6 years, and they have to go back and amend their 1040s for the last 3 years, and all that gets submitted in a package to the IRS. And to the extent that the taxpayer was non-willful, and the taxpayer can certify their non-willfulness in the certification, then they would be eligible for this Streamline program. But suffice to say, audits of taxpayers who made quiet disclosures, who inappropriately entered into the Streamline program, meaning that the taxpayer was more willful than they were non-willful, or those taxpayers who threw caution to the wind and made no effort whatsoever to come into voluntary compliance with respect to offshore accounts, these types of cases are ticking time bombs. The stakes could not be higher. One false step and your client could be doomed to spend the next decade of his life confined to a jail cell. After all, there are not just civil penalties for failing to file the FBAR, but there are criminal penalties. And there's, of course, the tax evasion statute. But suffice to say, the failure to file an FBAR, if it's deemed to be willful, the government could bring willful criminal charges against the taxpayer for failing to do so. And chances are that there's also going to be tax evasion charges leveled against the client as well. Even in the wake of Greenfield, the law is incredibly unsettled and the IRS is doggedly determined to catch tax cheats. For these reasons, tax practitioners are encouraged to reach out for and speak to a tax attorney who possesses the training and expertise needed to provide practical and sound advice to a person on invoking his Fifth Amendment privilege against incrimination. At the very least, the taxpayer should at least have a consultation with a tax attorney before making any decisions, because they have rippling effects. The IRS usually possesses incomplete and potentially inaccurate information to demonstrate that the taxpayer violated any U.S. tax laws, and is often desperate to obtain even a morsel of information in the hope that it will yield a more bountiful harvest. The travesty in this is that the taxpayer may legally be under no obligation to maintain or produce such information. So you don't want to, arbitrarily advise them to comply with a summons if there is a legitimate basis for contesting it. Because once again, the government may not have even a morsel of evidence to bring a criminal case. And yet you might be aware, on the other hand, of the fact that, there is some potential fraud. But nonetheless, you don't want to turn that information over without at least consulting with a tax attorney who can provide sound advice on whether it's necessary to comply with the summons. Practitioners must remain vigilant at all times and not be timid when it comes to asserting all available privileges to protect their client's rights. You don't want your client to be the next cooked goose gracing the IRS's Thanksgiving Day table, and the Fifth Amendment privilege may be the only thing keeping him out of prison. And we are drawing to the end of the presentation, but I do have a short add-on, because I did want to walk you through a little bit of information on FATCA and how FATCA works. So just bear with me for a second. I'm going to just get to that section of the presentation. Okay, what I want to do before I forget, because I am known to forget providing the code for these programs, and I want to make sure, most importantly, that you have this code. So just bear with me one second. All right, the code for today's program is M like Mike, and D like DeBliss, my last name, MD3367-101923. Once again, it's MD3367-101923. And that's the code for New York credit. Okay. Now let me get back into All right, so this is FATCA. Once again, it stands for the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. It's the way that the government attempts to obtain information from foreign bank accounts relating to U.S. persons who may or may not be dodging U.S. tax laws. So basically, the government has recognized that there is a substantial amount of money stored overseas that has gone unreported. And if it's gone unreported, that means that it's been untaxed, and that will continue to go unreported if left to the taxpayer to voluntarily disclose. So what Congress did is they passed the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. And what that does is it requires foreign banks to report specific information regarding their U.S. account holders to the IRS. It was passed in 2010 to clamp down on the use of foreign bank accounts by U.S. taxpayers to hide money that was otherwise subject to taxation in the U.S. It's the government's newest enforcement tool in its fight against international tax evasion. Okay. And we've already talked about the U.S. government taxing its U.S. citizens and residents on their worldwide income. We've talked about the FBAR. We've talked about the types of people that must file an FBAR. Why don't banks like
Esquire CLE's second verification code is EAT, E-A-T, all lowercase, EAT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is EAT, E-A-T, all lowercase, EAT. Please take a moment and write this down.
Like FATCA, well, it turns foreign banks into enforcement arms of the Internal Revenue Service. This allows the IRS to make sure they are collecting every possible dollar from U.S. taxpayers who have offshore assets. Although banks seemingly have two options, disclose account information on clients who are U.S. persons or pay a whopping 30% of all payments they receive from the U.S. to the IRS, most foreign banks would argue that they have only one real choice if they want to be around long enough to report next year's quarterly earnings, and that is to succumb to Uncle Sam's heavy-handed demands and turn over U.S. account holder information. From the perspective of U.S. taxpayers with unreported foreign accounts, it treats every taxpayer with a foreign bank account as though they are Al Capone. How so? Well, the IRS punishes such taxpayers with penalties that are so exorbitant that it could leave them with nothing more than the shirt on their backs. For example, willful civil FBAR penalties are the greater of $100,000 or 50% of the closing balance in the account as of the last day of filing the FBAR. Considering the fact that FBAR penalties are assessed per account and not per year, this could drive a taxpayer's FBAR penalties into the stratosphere. So there's critics that weigh in here. FATCA gets its teeth from two provisions. First, non-compliant foreign bank accounts, banks face a mandatory 30% withholding on payments from U.S.-based financial institutions. That is quite large. Second, the FATCA beefed up the ability of the Department of Justice to prosecute foreign banks criminally who were assisting U.S. taxpayers with tax evasion. So the first cut is the deepest, and the first cut came in Switzerland. Switzerland's financial industry was landfall for Hurricane FATCA, which was nothing short of a Category 5 storm. Under FATCA, Swiss banking powerhouse UBS was forced to turn over the names and information of 4,000 U.S. taxpayers. In order to settle a corporate criminal action for failure to comply, UBS paid a whopping $780 million to the U.S. Many Swiss institutions got the point and came into compliance. To prove its power to bankers who didn't comply with UBS, the Department of Justice's next target was Switzerland's oldest bank, Wegelin and Company. That shot proved fatal. Wegelin paid $74 million in fines, restitution, and forfeitures, and ceased to do business to avoid criminal liability. In August of 2013, Switzerland raised the white flag. To avoid further prosecution, Switzerland signed a non-prosecution agreement with the U.S. government for banks that had facilitated American tax evasion. In theory, such agreements guarantee banks immunity from prosecution, but the devil is in the details. In December, 100 Swiss banks joined. This is going back, of course, to 2013, so this information is a little old. But back in December of 2013, 100 Swiss banks joined in the proposed amnesty deal with the Department of Justice. However, it appears that Switzerland and many other countries got the message clearly. The U.S. will no longer tolerate the non-disclosure of U.S. taxpayer information. It appears that the Department of Justice may have attempted to slide a couple of extra provisions into the NPA, including first that the bank must cooperate fully with the DOJ, the IRS, and any other domestic or foreign law enforcement agency designated by the Department of Justice. So not just DOJ and the IRS, but any other domestic or foreign law enforcement agency designated by the Department of Justice. Second, the banks must assist the Department of Justice or any designated domestic or foreign law enforcement agency in any investigation, prosecution, or civil proceeding arising from or related to the NPA. Third, the foreign bank must provide testimony as needed to enable the U.S. to use the information and evidence provided by the bank under the NPA. Fourth, the foreign bank must provide the Department of Justice with all requested information, documents, records, or other tangible evidence not protected by legal privilege regarding the covered conduct. Next, the foreign bank must retain all records relating to its U.S. cross-border business for a period of 10 years from the NPA's termination date. And finally, the agreement describes the circumstances under which the Department of Justice may determine that a bank has violated the NPA and may be prosecuted. So the banks, of course, weren't very happy to hear that, they could be prosecuted even after signing an NPA with the U.S. government. That didn't really give them a warm and cozy feeling that the U.S. government could tear away that immunity and subsequently prosecute them. 73 Swiss banks responded in a joint letter saying they wouldn't sign the NPA as proposed. The bank's objections were fairly simple. Since when does the U.S. Department of Justice have the authority to make a foreign bank cooperate in investigations by other foreign governments? That was what was enshrined in the first, in point one here of the NPA, that the banks had to cooperate with any other domestic or foreign law enforcement agency designated by the Department of Justice. Second, the fact that the NPA contained language basically saying that the Department of Justice reserved the right to change its mind and prosecute anyway. So is that really a non-prosecution agreement or a license for a fishing expedition that may lead to prosecution anyway? As more countries are pushed to the brink to share tax information, the focus will shift to America's willingness to reciprocate. Who can forget the expression, what's good for the goose is good for the gander? At present, the U.S. does not provide the same detailed information about foreign account holders who bank with U.S. banks to foreign governments that it requires foreign banks to provide to it. So for example, Switzerland, Swiss clients and Swiss citizens that bank with U.S. banks, the U.S. government isn't obligated to provide the same quantum of information to the Swiss government that the Swiss government is required to provide to the U.S. government for U.S. persons that are banking with those Swiss banks. So is there hypocrisy going on here? Absolutely. Once again, the U.S. does not provide the same quantum of information about its foreign account holders who bank with its banks as it requires the foreign banks to provide to the U.S. government. So yes, it is stark, and it's staring, it's out there. Now, we've reached the end of the program, so unfortunately, I can't get into the mechanics of how information gets exchanged. Perhaps that'll be the topic of a future program. So I thank you so much for attending today's program, and please look forward to some future programs in the realm of tax as well as in the realm of litigation. We have a bunch coming up. I wish you the very best.